Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. This summer, keep up to date on the day's news with Up First, the morning news podcast from NPR. In just 10 minutes, Up First gives you a quick morning update on the news you need to start the day. Wake up with Up First tomorrow morning on the NPR One app and wherever you listen to podcasts.
Our plan this week was to assemble an in-depth discussion of The Dark Tower, the long-awaited movie adaptation of the Stephen King fantasy book series.
Yeah, and then we saw it, which tries to compress the 9 books of that series, thousands of pages of characters and storylines, into a 95-minute sort of YA-inflected action movie.
Yeah, none of us liked the movie. And more to the point, none of us thought it was interesting enough to support an entire segment of this show.
So we're calling an audible, we're switching it up, and instead talking about Stephen King himself. He sold hundreds of millions of books and written in a lot of genres in addition to horror, fantasy, literary fiction, science fiction, nonfiction.
Yeah, and many of those books have been adapted into TV shows and plays and graphic novels and, of course, movies. I'm Stephen Thompson.
And I'm Glenn Weldon. We're talking Stephen King's work and offering recommendations for stuff to read or watch instead of the Dark Tower movie on this episode of Pop Culture Happy Hour.
A quick reminder that we're coming to you twice a week this summer, spreading the same content across 2 episodes. Linda Holmes is in LA for a little while longer, so we've got 2 guests this week, including Barry Hardiman of Weekend Edition. Hello, Barry.
Hello.
And we have got my dear pal, formerly of the AV Club and The Dissolve, and now of The Verge and The Next Picture Show podcast, my buddy Tasha Robinson. Hello, Tasha.
Hello, Stephen. You flatter me. Please keep it up.
I will always flatter you. You are one of my favorites. We are ditching The Dark Tower, the movie, this week.
Fair enough.
Instead, we are discussing Stephen King adaptations that are actually good. So, Barry Hardiman, what is your favorite Stephen King adaptation?
So, I'm limited when it comes to Stephen King movie adaptations because I really cannot do horror, like actual horror. So that makes me the most, probably the most boring member of this group, in that my favorite, I'm not going to say Shawshank, but my absolute favorite is still Stand By Me. And guess what, guys? I rewatched it recently and it totally holds up.
Oh, yeah.
It's really wonderful. And the combination of like Rob Reiner's nostalgia with dread with this King is just beautiful. And I still love it. Totally worth it. So it's based on King's novella, The Body, and it is about a group of tween boys. One of them is Wesley Crusher, another thing I had forgotten.
Yes.
Sorry, I'm just it's like, it's all the first time.
Will Wheaton, he's like the
he's the narrator. Gordy. Yeah, he's Gordy. Yeah. And River Phoenix, it's like a hilarious Jerry O'Connell. I, for some reason, can't remember the fourth one, but it's someone else ridiculous.
It's a Corey
Feldman. It's a Feldman. It's a Corey. Anyway.
We've got Kiefer Sutherland in there. One of the kids. But,
it is a great 80s piece of like all the people that you may have had on your wall at some point. But it's about a group of tween boys who are off to find, they're looking for the body of a boy. And it's really, of another boy. And it's really mostly sort of about their friendship as they wander around looking for it. And it's told from the point of view of Gordy, who I think in the beginning, this is a recent watch, but not that recent, who in the beginning sort of tells you that the futures of these boys are in doubt, which is actually the thing that then hangs over the whole movie and the book. And it's so gorgeous because you keep forgetting about it as they josh and laugh with each other and have this just wonderful boy chemistry. It's just such pubescent chemistry. That came out, you know what I mean? Not like such boy chemistry.
Well, speaking of pubescent chemistry, that movie came out at the exact right time for me. I felt I was the Gordy.
I felt seen. I love it.
Now on, were you covered with leeches at any point during this childhood of yours?
Because if there's one demographic that is really underserved, it's people who are adolescents in the 80s, especially boys.
So glad they had something for you.
Yeah,
really
exactly.
Good stuff.
Good pick, though. Wonderful, wonderful movie. How about you? How about you, Tasha?
Well, in the 80s, there was this run of, I want to say, really successful, both conceptually and as adaptation films, Cujo, Christine, and Firestarter. And I saw none of those in the 1980s. I was also afraid of horror at that point in my life. So I came to them late. And I suspect if I'd seen them back when they first came out, I would have processed them as schlock. But there's a schlocky element to Stephen King that I think is one of the reasons he's so successful. And I think we'll get into that in a little bit. But I think that those three films actually pretty well nail the humanism of some of his work, the way the characters work with each other, and what's actually scary about the story. They're all very low-key, dialed-down films in a way. And John Carpenter's Christine, I mean, it's a John Carpenter movie. It's trashy, but it's immaculately made. All of these films kind of pale next to a film that is incredibly different in tone, and that's Stanley Kubrick's The Shining. Mm-hmm. I know that that is Stephen King's least favorite adaptation of his work.
He hates that movie.
He hates it so much. And he takes just the cheapest little pot shots at Stanley Kubrick at random intervals. I was rereading the Rolling Stone interview where he explains it like in a paragraph very succinctly, and I understand his points. You know, I understand that it's not exactly the most feminist movie. I understand that Jack Nicholson is too crazy for him from the start, that it's not about the same redemption themes that he wanted in the story. It's not about the slow process of going mad, but it's a beautifully shot movie. It is utterly terrifying. I think Kubrick just nails the uncanniness that is one of the things that is frightening in Stephen King's work. It's so well executed, both on a storytelling level and on a scares level. It's so gorgeous. I really love The Shining as a piece of filmmaking, even if King would fight me on that one.
So I am not by any means a Stephen King expert. I would say, I mean, Stand By Me is way, way up there as just a favorite movie in general. I would also call it, and again, this is so obvious, this is not an esoteric pick, but I love Misery.
Oh,
and
yes.
And the
yes, but how do you feel about movies?
The intensity, the scares, the relatability. One thing that I think King does well, his plots tend to be, in general, there are exceptions, pretty easy to explain. He is a writer. She is a super fan. Mm-hmm. She waxes foot. You get there.
This is a great log line.
You get there pretty quickly. And when you look over the plots of Stephen King stories and the movies that I think have been the most creatively and commercially successful, I think the most successful ones often don't necessarily have an element of the supernatural. If you look at a story like Misery is just a person versus a person. Stand By Me is a coming-of-age mm-hmm. story with a body. Mm-hmm. There are still horror elements, but they're more everyday. They're more relatable. And I wonder if that is a factor in what makes a successful Stephen King adaptation versus maybe a lesser one, or one that, as Tasha said, qualifies as schlock.
Well, let me push back on that a little bit, because I think his work often isn't about engaging the loftier, more esoteric brain functions. His work is visceral, and I don't mean that it's bloody. I mean that it is about engaging the body. He wants you to feel the emotion of fear, and he's targeting your emotional center, which is why I think when supernatural evil comes into it, I'm totally there with it, because that's what I want. I want speculative. I don't think he handles the mundane, everyday evil particularly believably, because he's not interested in that. When you come up with a school bully or an abusive husband or a hateful prison guard in much of his work, they are just cartoonishly evil, mustache-twirling evil, for a very specific reason, because he wants you to feel not
just... Scary clown evil.
Well, but the scary clown is supernatural, but like I'm talking about the other people in the town.
All clowns are bad. Wants
you to feel when they get their comeuppance. In many ways, a Stephen King story is about the comeuppance that the person who has been a jerk for the entire book finally gets. And when it happens, it's incredibly satisfying.
I want that.
But to get there, you need to kind of paint these evil people as capital E evil in a way that I don't buy.
I would agree with you. I do happen to love Misery, frankly, because she is so cartoonish, but I also recognize her because I understand the feeling of super fan and
sure.
You know, could certainly, I wouldn't whack a foot, but might like handcuff to a bed. I don't know.
This is taking a turn.
I know. But I think for me, the thing, I mean, when we talk about the different kinds of King evil, you know, for me, the best evil that he represents, or he does, for me, the book that works the best is 11/22/63, in which the horror isn't really horror. Mm-hmm. It's just the fact that time marches on. And for me, that was the first time that all of the characters felt more well-drawn, and they were all up against the same thing, which is that Kennedy's going to get assassinated. Time is going to march on. And there was that. So that, for me, I can see what you're saying. But for me, that's where his evil is most successful.
Yeah, I'm also going to push back on that original statement that sort of the less supernatural makes for the better story in King. Because, well, I mean, I totally agree with Glenn that he draws evil humanity very, very broadly, and that he is not what one calls such L. But to me, what makes Stephen King interesting is, like, he has more of a sense of time and place and ordinariness than any other horror writer I think I've ever read. I think there's a tendency in horror to get so excited by fast forward. If you're writing something with monsters or aliens or ghosts or any of the big bugaboos, there is a tendency to want to get to that part. And I don't feel that in Stephen King. Now, that can make him very discursive. It can make him very wandering. And people have rolled their eyes for literally decades now about his rabbit trails. I love his rabbit trails. I love his character building and his world building. But all of that goes into creating a very dialed down mundanity that when something supernatural walks in the door, it becomes all the more uncanny for it. I think where the movies fall down is too many of them are excited to get to the scary stuff and don't really care about the characters. I've always gotten the feeling that Stephen King cares about his characters deeply, even the ones that get mulched in horrible ways, even the cartoonish evil ones with like 15 mustaches that they're all trying to twirl simultaneously. He cares about those characters, and you care about those characters, whether you want them to die or you want them to live. You get involved in the story, and an awful lot of bad Stephen King adaptations just make the mistake of not trying to make you care about the people or the story except as cannon fodder.
I go back with Stephen King. I read his earlier stuff in high school because I was in high school, and that was the law. And because I was resisting it, I guess, for a variety of reasons, I began to pick up on what struck me as a sameness. And I started to think, okay, I get this guy. Scary stuff happens in italics. So when you turn a page and you see some italics, you know, to kind of gird your loins. And then I thought to myself, okay, that was the moment I thought I need to branch out and maybe find some writers whose narrative success is not font dependent and then use some other tools and the tricks. And so years passed, and this is how hopelessly bougie I am. He had a story in The New Yorker.
Oh my God, I can't.
Okay, hold on. So I was at Iowa at the time, the Iowa Writers' Workshop.
This gets better and better.
My job was to resentfully see that anybody who got published in The New Yorker,
sure,
especially when it was a promising new voice like Stephen frickin' King, a plucky young upstart like Stephen King, and the story was pretty good. Turns out the story's pretty good. It was a riff on Young Goodman Brown, the Nathaniel Hawthorne short story, and I remember just being impressed despite myself. But in terms of his fiction, it just doesn't, it still doesn't grab me. It still doesn't. He is just so much better for me about writing about the process of writing than writing itself.
But give me a couple thoughts quickly on writing in case we don't get back to it, because we have many other things to cover.
Yes, Professor Weldon.
For both these books, Dance Macabre, which is about horror, not just writing it, but reading it and watching it, and On Writing, which of course is more about the process of writing.
The craft.
That's exactly the point, Stephen, because this is something I used to give selections from these books to my students, because students who are learning how to write fiction need to read about the craft, not the art. There's enough crap out there in the world about the art of writing and being a writer. What they need is something that's clear, practical, useful, written in a voice, a very self-deprecating and funny voice that speaks in a way that dissolves the boundaries between the act of writing and being a writer. But reading these books, you get that writing is not an identity, it's an action. It's not who you are, it's what you do. Mm-hmm. And if more writers were trained on that and had gotten that at a very formative time in their life, we'd have a lot less insufferably pretentious writers in the world right now.
But the bars would be less full.
The bars
and maybe
would be
a little less fun as a person that also that also has an MA in fiction.
That's exactly
pipe
right.
Sales and the sales of leather elbow patches.
Exactly. Less Bukowski, right. more King.
And also, it was really important to read you should have the draft of the book in 3 months.
Yeah, well.
Which I know. But it gave me, it was odd to me because it gave me the feeling like, you can do this. Like, anyone exactly. can do. It was such a you can do it.
That's the point.
It's so encouraging.
That's what a lot of like introductory writing things just don't do. It's always this thing that's off there in the ether to show that the only thing that's standing between you and that is just sitting down and doing it.
Butt in seat.
Hugely important.
That said, I mean, there is a degree to which both of those books, I mean, both of those books do have a certain amount of, if one does it the way I do it, then it will get done. And the process doesn't work for everyone.
Sure.
If that was how it worked, everybody else would also have literally 30 New York Times.
Right. And he's clearly compulsive.
Yes, exactly. He's to the point where he almost died and he said he was going to stop writing and he couldn't stop writing. He got to a certain age and he said he was going to retire and he couldn't stop writing. Mm-hmm. But Danse Macabre has one of my favorite thoughts of all time on the process of writing. He basically says, no one is exactly sure of what they mean on any given subject until they have written their thoughts down. Mm-hmm. I similarly believe we have very little understanding of what we have thought until we have submitted those thoughts to those who are at least as intelligent as ourselves, which is kind of how I feel about coming on this podcast. or really, one of the things that I think that those two books really get at is the idea that thinking and talking and living in the world are as important as butt in seat.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to wrap up our conversation. You know, we began this discussion by saying, don't bother with The Dark Tower. Let's say you've got this Stephen King itch.
That sounds like a terrible Stephen King novel. It's just called
Itch.
Right, but they're thinner and itchy.
I just want to have you guys hurl some recommendations to wrap up our segment. I have in my notes here, Tasha wrote down.
Oh, I want to hear this.
The Tommyknockers, parentheses, don't look at me that way, I will fight you. So I'm going to start with you, Tasha, if you want to defend the Tommyknockers, but also give us a few other King recommendations.
The Tommyknockers is one of his most despised novels. He despises it. He says it's too long and wandering and he would have cut it down. But that book just has some mental byways in it that I find exceptionally beautiful. It's ultimately about aliens, but the path to get there wanders through yet another of King's many, many writers with alcoholism battling his addiction. And in this case, not battling it particularly well. And there's a segment in that book where he's at a poetry reading and he loses his way. He's reading his poetry and he kind of forgets what he's doing. And he stands there wool gathering and loses his audience and then finds a way to bring them back. And none of that is necessary to the plot. It's one of the better short stories that I've read. So, and that book has just such a sense of the creeping dreads in a way that is one of my favorite things about King. So, I love that story. And I will, in fact, fight all comers to defend it, including King himself. And I think if Stanley Kubrick held him off as long as he could, I can take him. To go back and give myself the lie about his supernatural books or his best ones, my flat-out favorite Stephen King book ever, the one that I hand to people who say why Stephen King, is The Long Walk, which he originally published as Richard Bachman back when he was putting out a bunch of books under a pseudonym, basically just to see if people would still like him if he wasn't Stephen King. And this book is about 100 boys who are set out on a walk with men with guns. And if they drop below a certain speed too many times, they are shot. And whoever the last survivor gets whatever they want. It's a very, very slightly sketched future dystopia. Mm-hmm. I think it's just a masterful example of completely mundane, no monsters, no supernatural, no anything horror that's just about people. King loves his interiority. He loves being in people's heads. And when he does it badly, it's this horrible crutch where his characters communicate psychically and give each other all the answers. When he does it well, again, it becomes just about that scene-setting experience. So The Long Walk, all-time favorite Stephen King.
All right, Barry, how about you?
So for a long time, I thought that The Stand and Tommyknockers and Gunslinger, which is that really was Stephen King. And then we interviewed him for his what was being sold as this big literary novel, which was 11-22-63, which I've talked about a little bit. And it is. It's really, really good. It's the story of a high school teacher who finds a portal back in time in a Maine diner. You don't say, it's in Maine. And I will say also, I do love all the little dairy bits. And I like a writer who's got all the little Easter eggs of his thing. But it's a gorgeous book about, you know, what you can and cannot change about yourself. And then the other one I would recommend, which is actually very gory, but I think is a really great short story about childbirth, is called The Breathing Method. And it is the fourth in different seasons, which contains Shawshank, which is called Rita Hayworth and the Shawshank Redemption, Apt Pupil, which you may have heard of, and The Body, which we've talked about, and The Breathing Method, which no one would want to make into a movie ever because it involves a decapitation, is really, really good. It takes place, it's the story, it's a, another story within a story. A doctor who is at this in this very odd gentleman's club, which is somewhere in the Dark Tower, I don't know, some there's some kind of alternate universe happening, tells a story of this patient that he had, a young woman who in the 30s gets pregnant out of wedlock and is determined to have the baby and practices his breathing technique, which is an early Lamaze. And I think that's all I should say since I already said the other thing about what might be in it. But it's really, really moving, and it is horror. I mean, it's gory and weird, and I've read it a couple times. And I still think it holds up as just one of these really, really great allegories of, you know, the horror that is the everyday and also how people can survive it even if they don't actually survive it.
Thank you, Barry Hardiman. All right. Well, if you have thoughts about Stephen King or The Dark Tower, come and find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or on Twitter at PCHH. When we come back, it'll be our favorite segment of this week and every week, What is Making Us Happy? So stick around.
Support for NPR and the following message come from the Platinum Card from American Express. There's a great big world out there, and no other card lets you experience it like the Platinum Card, backed by the service and security of American Express. Support for this NPR podcast and the following message come from USA Network's The Center, a new limited series following a young mother played by Jessica Biel, who commits a startling act of violence she can't explain. A police investigator becomes obsessed with uncovering the truth, and together they discover the secrets hidden in her past. Everyone knows she did it. No one knows why. The series also stars Bill Pullman and Christopher Abbott. The Center, Wednesdays at 10, 9 Central on USA Network.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. It is time, as always, for What is Making Us Happy This Week. Glenn Weldon, what's making you happy this week, buddy?
Season 3 of Fargo just ended up, Fargo on FX. This season started slow, and the early hype was all about Ewan McGregor playing two characters. And I thought it was off to a poor start, frankly. But I forgot that every season starts off like this. It takes a while for this show always to, A, find its level and what it's about, but it also takes a while for the connections to other seasons and to the original film to kind of cohere. And when it does, late in the season, I'm not going to say which episode, because anytime you say, oh, wait till X episode, then you get to X episode and you're like, that was it? So I'm just going to say, late in the season, there is a barn burner of an episode where it's just filled with tension and weirdness and humor that is just exactly what you want out of this show, that casts this long shadow to everything that has preceded it and everything that goes after it. And you realize watching it that everything you've seen that you thought was just going off on tangents is justified because of this episode, the stuff that happens in a way that is exactly the opposite of, say, Twin Peaks. I do not anticipate feeling this the way I felt watching that episode of Fargo, season three, when I'm watching Twin Peaks. But man, get into it. It's only 10 episodes long. Some fantastic performances, some fantastic scene setting. Season three of Fargo.
Thank you, Glenn Weldon. Barry Hardiman, what's making you happy this week?
So television, too, is making me happy. And I've been watching Andrea Savage's show, I'm Sorry. She plays the president, Montez, Laura Montez, on Veep. But she's got her own show now. And it's very, very funny. It's in the, it's another sort of loosely based on her life. She's a comedian with a daughter. It is filthy. Like, so filthy. At one point, we went back because there's on our DVR, there was an, you could do explicit or not explicit. And I was like, we got to go back and watch the not explicit because how the are they going to do
how
that?
The explicit
how
are they going to do
possible?
That?
Possible. How the explicit? Exactly. But it's really darling. She has so much energy and is so funny. You know, the pilot's a little rocky, but her charisma, I think, really carries it. And it's also just this real sort of send up of a certain slice of LA that I have a little fond spot for. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I love the lady comics. I love them. I do. It's called I'm Sorry with Andrea Savage, and it is on True, that's TRU, TV.
Thank you.
Clever little name.
Yeah, thank you, Barry Hardiman. Tasha Robinson, what's making you happy this week?
There is a podcast a friend turned me onto called the 20% True Podcast, and it is a woman named Carolyn Rahman, who is a short fiction writer. She just finished what she's calling the first season of the 20% True Podcast. That season is called Modern Monsters, and every single one of the first 12 episodes of the 20% True Podcast are these delightful little short stories about monsters in the modern world. A vampire looking for a roommate who answered an ad on Craigslist. A bunch of harpies who steal Doritos from people on the street and scold them for their crimes, like the most dialed down version of harpy punishment of all times. There's a terrific one that's episode number 7, The Takedown of the Gargoyle Containment Unit, which is basically just a battle scene between gargoyles and a SWAT team with a tremendous payoff. They're between about 12 minutes and 20 minutes long, so they're nice little bite-sized things. Carolyn reads them herself, and I process her as kind of a blend between Kelly Link and Neil Gaiman. She has a terrific sense for description, for environment, and there's just a little whimsy, but not enough to be cloying. If people are looking for a starting place, I highly recommend episode 3, The Spider Woman, which is just a deliriously fantastic little fable. They're very, very satisfying, and they're very creative and clever. So the 20% True Podcast, season 1, Modern Monsters.
Nice. Thank you, Tasha Robinson. So I've just got two things really quickly. Speaking of podcasts, I got to appear on last week's episode of It's Been a Minute with Sam Sanders. Mm-hmm. Me and Sam and Rachel Martin.
Yep.
I think if you like Pop Culture Happy Hour, it shares DNA. It's very fun. The other thing is that inspired by the release of the movie The Dark Tower, I broke out one of my favorite childhood board games, Dark Tower, from Milton Bradley, which is a wonderful, wonderful game that where at the center of the board, there is a gigantic plastic tower that no longer works. And everybody who has ever had this board game has a broken tower, and it's very, very expensive to find a game where the tower actually works. Mine does not. Glenn Weldon told me about the Dark Tower app by a gentleman named Floyd Ressler, who coded this wonderful iPhone simulation of the Dark Tower in the board game Dark Tower. And over the weekend, I got to play it for the first time in decades with my pals, Jessica Reedy and Glenn Weldon.
Yeah.
We gathered around a table and nerded out. So delightful to revisit this wonderful, wonderful game.
Oh, it's so good.
It made me very, very happy. So that brings us to the end of our show. You can find all of us on Twitter. You can find me at IDislikeSteven. You can find Glenn at GH Weldon. You can find Barry Hardiman at B Hardiman. You can find Tasha at Tasha Robinson. You can find our producer, Jessica, at Jessica_Reedy, and our producer emeritus, Mike Katziff, at Mike Katziff. That's KATZIF. Also, if you like the show, please leave a review on Apple Podcasts. It helps new listeners discover us. Thanks to all of you for being here.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks to all of you, and we will see you right back here next week.